Welcome to episode 71 of Talk Eastern Europe, a podcast dedicated to discussing issues related to Central and Eastern Europe and the official podcast of the New Eastern Europe magazine. This podcast is a listener-supported podcast, and our listeners donate to us via our Patreon page, for which we are extremely grateful. So if you enjoy listening to the podcast, please support us at www.patreon.com/talkeasterneurope. And don't forget to listen to the end of the podcast for our traditional patron shout-out. My name is Adam Reichert, and with me is the other co-host of the podcast, Maciek Makulski. Hi, Maciek.
Hello, Adam. Hello, everyone. It's great to have you with us. Each week, we bring you an in-depth discussion on a topic related to our region. And this week, we are looking at the recent developments with Russia and the region and relations with the West. As a reminder, Talk Eastern Europe is a member of Europod, a network of podcasts which covers various views on political and social trends in Europe and beyond.
Thanks, Maciek. Well, this episode is quite a big one, so let's get started. So as we said in the opening, this episode is one that is going to cover the situation and relations, recent relations with Russia. I know we've been talking about Russia a lot on the podcast lately, but really I think the context of this episode is the developments that have been taking place mostly in April, in mid-April when there were alarms being rung by Ukrainian officials that Russian troops were building up in both Crimea and the areas on the border with Ukraine. Some estimates said between 100,000 and 150,000 troops were massing on the border. And there was a lot of nervousness taking place at this time. This episode is something that, you know, we've been trying to cover during this period, but it was very challenging because the developments were happening so quickly. But I think now that we kind of have a clearer picture of what happened and what is happening, we saw the response of the West, which included some tough expulsions of Russian so-called diplomats from different countries, including the Czech Republic, but also Poland and the U.S. and others, and the Russian response as well. So, Maciek, why don't you introduce to us a little bit more of the topic from your perspective, because you're the one who did the interview. And also, it's quite a long one, so I don't want to give too much away. I think you guys cover a lot.
Sure. I sat with Agnieszka Legutska, who is a senior research fellow in Russia at the Polish Institute of International Affairs. And she is also a professor in security studies at Wistula University in Warsaw. And our regular listeners probably remember Agnieszka from the episode we recorded last year.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, it was in April, if I remember correctly. So the pandemic was in initial phase, and we were discussing also developments in Russia, which were at that time of a bit more internal and domestic maybe character, because at that time it was when Russia tried to, you know, introduce very quickly changes in law which secured next terms for Putin. Right. And as you already said, now we had a very hot topic regarding this Russian troops at the borders of Ukraine. So, but I think the most important aspect of the interview is to explain the rationale which is behind Russia's behavior, because Agnieszka describes it and explains it in a very good way, showing that, you know, what are the interests of Russia and what is the perception of Russia about their position in the world, position in the region, what Russia thinks about Europe and the United States. So we didn't focus too much on describing the events, because I think they are already well described in media. But we tried to explain why Russia behaves like that. And one more remark to what you have said, because I think it's a very good introduction. But from what I have read about this announced withdrawal of troops by Russia, it's not that certain. I think there it was announced, but probably majority of troops were not withdrawn yet, and we are not sure if they will be. And it might be also perceived as only a temporary easing of tension between Russia and Ukraine and Russia and the West in broader perspective. And let's remember that in September this year, we will have another military drills, Zapad, they call Zapad. So we have to really, we have to focus on what Russia is doing right now. And probably we will also talk about it in future episodes.
Absolutely. And I think we also have to keep in mind this week the US Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in Kiev, and there was some show of solidarity, I guess. And I know that there were some reports that Zelensky and Ukraine are requesting even more support militarily from the United States. So I imagine some of the reason why some of these troops maybe weren't withdrawn were to also kind of be a reminder of how dangerous the situation really is in that part of the world and this region. As you said, Maciek, the tensions, may have eased for a moment, but this is, can heat up again quite quickly.
Okay, so as you said, the interview is quite long, so maybe let's now listen to it and we will do a quick summary afterwards.
Great.
And I am now joined by Agnieszka Lewicka, a senior research fellow in Russia at the Polish Institute of International Affairs and professor in security studies at Vistula University in Warsaw. Hi Agnieszka, welcome back to Talkistan Europe.
Thank you for the invitation, and I'm very happy to join you once again.
Last time we talked, it was 1 year ago. The pandemic still was in its initial phase, and we focus more on internal developments in Russia, since the Kremlin made steps to secure two further terms of Putin as the president. And you said at that time, if I remember correctly, that it means Putin stays forever. From today's perspective, we can say at least it is still valid, but today also we're gonna focus on a bit different issues. And we will try to explain what is the logic behind heating up the conflict in eastern Ukraine, and what are the social moods in Russia, how big is actually support for Navalny, and what does it all mean before the parliamentary election in Russia to be held later this year. So I propose let's start from probably the most important issue now, which is the process of mobilizing and moving additional units of Russian army to regions bordering eastern Ukraine and Crimea. And the question I have here is, why does Putin need it now?
Okay. Thank you for a lot of questions. I will try to organize it somehow. Many happens during this year, pandemic, changes of constitution and new tensions with the West. And I would put this, new extensive military exercises around the Ukraine borders in the broader perspective, exactly which is connected with the pandemic, with the position of Putin in the Kremlin, and at the same time those moods of Russian societies that you want to ask. So from my perspective, Russia has recognized that as a result of pandemic, the EU as a whole, and maybe the West as a whole, would be particularly weaker, which would allow Russia to undermine its position in the world and make it difficult to coordinate with the US. Because also during that year, we are just at the beginning of new administration of Joe Biden, which as a United States nowadays, Russia's authorities recognize as an unfriendly country. So taking into account all those elements and the situation with pandemic in Russia, which is quite stable, but influenced the Russians' perception of Mr. Putin as a president forever. So taking all the things into account, those new tensions between Russia and Ukraine and new military posture, and I would say that it's a part of the disinformation campaign and information warfare. Because since 2014, Russia is able to attack Ukrainian territory because it's strengthened its military position in Crimea and at the same time near border to Ukraine. Around it, you know, those numbers are differ when depends on the report and methodology, but it's around 100 to 150,000 soldiers around Ukraine territory. So what we have observed since the beginning of this year was something additionally that in Twitter, in many films, in YouTube, we as observers could see a new weapons, a new soldiers which were who were transferred to the border of Ukraine. And why it was what kind of goals Putin was having. So first of all, he wanted to push Ukrainian authorities to fulfill the Minsk agreement accordingly Russian interest. What means that Donbas should be integrated to Ukrainian country, and in that sense, that could be a Trojan horse when it comes to Kiev. Internal as well external policy that would block, of course, Ukrainian membership to NATO or to European Union. So that is a goal of Russian authorities towards Ukraine. But at the same time, in the broader perspective, as we started, that means that Russia would like to somehow test the new administration in the White House, and that's why that was a testing, exam for the Joe Biden, how he will act accordingly. What he was saying that he will support internal integrity, territorial integrity of Ukraine, and support of military and politically this country. Especially that Joe Biden is following the same idea as his as the previous president, that the main foe and the rival is China. So actually, Ukraine is not the priority for Joe Biden, but at the same time, Russian authorities wanted to shore or some kind of test the American support for the Europeans and and especially for Ukraine. And I would say, after a lots of events that we have observed, meaning at this call Mr. Biden to Putin, then imposing new sanctions, I would say that that test was quite well done by Americans authorities, at the same time Ukrainian, and I say even whole West, because after a while of tensions, how we were like in the middle of tensions, then the many experts were saying, okay, we will have another war. Mr. Shoigu, who is Minister of Defense in Russia, he said that okay, we will de-escalate and move those weapons and soldiers from the south of Russia.
So let me jump in here and ask additionally. So Russia sees now that or didn't expect such strong and decisive reaction from the United States and the West as a whole, right?
I think that yes, Russian authorities wanted to test on what level those Western support is really fruitful and, essence of this support. And Ukraine become a top media topic when it comes to Western media in US and at the same time in NATO countries. So that support, that very straight message towards Russian authorities, I think that in Russian in Russia there is a sentence that let's see who will blink first. And from my perspective, Russian authorities actually blinked first because they've noticed that there is a strong support to Ukraine, and Ukrainian authorities, especially Mr. Volodymyr Zelensky, the president of Ukraine, did not move back, did not accept any dialogue with those locals and separatists, because everyone in the West, and especially in Ukraine, knows that behind them there is always Kremlin.
And what are the risks for Russia? Because there is also a context of Nord Stream 2, and I wanted to ask you whether isn't Russia contributing to the cancellation of this project somehow due to these hostile and aggressive moves towards Ukraine? Because there is of course always this question about how long the West will wait for a change of modus operandi of Russia. How do you see that?
Yes, the Nord Stream 2 is the project that needs to be examined separately somehow. Because when we look at Ukraine, there is no only Ukraine, right? So when we talk about West and the Russian relations, the Ukraine is on one hand a subject, but on the other hand, the object of politics. And when we talk about Nord Stream 2, we need to also consider not only Russia-US relations or Russia-European Union relations, because there is one proxy, very important proxy in those in this picture, especially Germany. But because when it comes to Germany, Energiewende, this energy transformation in this country, from economical prosperity point of view, they think that it is necessary for them to have a cheap Russian gas to become some kind of hub for the Russian gas in European Union, especially towards central European countries and also Ukraine. So from the German perspective, it is very important politically and economically, project. So Russian authorities do not examine or somehow put on Nord Stream 2 on agenda towards the United States, because in some way they use Germany as a proxy, because Russia knows that for Germany it is very important project. So they use Germany position towards new administration, Joe Biden's administration, to, for example, block any additional sanctions over this project, and especially make some kind of agreement how this project, how this gas pipeline will be introduced into the practice. Because now we know that US and Germany's authorities are talking about some kind of, let's say, deal, how to use this pipeline. And Ukraine is on agenda, especially because of security matters. Because we can imagine that without any kind of connections, any transportation connections through Ukraine will be a territory for invasion just like that. Nowadays, Russia's authorities need to take into account that some part of their gas transportation to Europe is going through the Ukraine territory. So they need to take into account when they calculate politically invade or not invade Ukraine. After the full implementation of Nord Stream 2, they have a free three will or three conditions for invading Ukraine, because they can. I mean, they will have an opportunity to do that.
It was very interesting what you have said, that it was a test for the US, this aggression to non-aggression, this heating up of or mobilizing forces at the border of Ukraine was a test for the West, and the test went quite successful for the West. So do you think we can expect some significant change of approach the West towards Russia? Because in the background, part of the picture on we have here is also the recent diplomatic crisis, which started when Czech Republic decided to expel 18, if I remember correctly, employees of the
Yes.
embassy of Russian Federation. And it was very briefly, it was a reaction to the result of an investigation which concluded that concluded that there were some reliable suspicions that two Russian military intelligence agents were involved in the explosion of ammunition depots in 2014 in the Czech Republic.
Yes, and we know those guys because Bashirov and
Exactly.
Petrov was also responsible for a Skripal attack in 2018. At least
Yes.
this one
Yes. So
is recognized.
exactly. This is very important. So this is not the first case we know of this kind that Russia did. So the question is about this red line. Maybe you know because it looks like Russia really had put all cards on the table already. Everything is rather clear. What is their policy towards Ukraine, towards the West? As you said, strategically, Russia even sees that the pandemic may cause that, or Russia is expecting that the West will be weakened, and this can and Russia can benefit from it. So yeah, the question is, but the first question was, what can be reaction from the West, and do you expect any significant change here?
Okay, so yes, a lot of questions, and let's concentrate on the issue about this confrontational policy of Russia towards the West, and how the West can manage Russia in the future in that sense. So I would say, and everyone knows that since 2014, from the annexation of Crimea, this confrontation is evolving and all the time. But nowadays, after the pandemic, or at the end of pandemic, now we can observe a new dynamics in this confrontational policy from the Kremlin, but at the same time, some elements of rival policy is on the West, especially US policy, because the West is very, broad understanding, and we need to understand also how the calculation of Russian authorities, because as I said at the beginning, they on one hand consider US as a main rival, and they have a respect towards US. But at the same time, after pandemic, they consider European Union countries as a very weak one. And this diagnosis that European Union will be weaker and weaker when it comes to the international relations as an actor, that brought Russian authorities to the conclusion that if they cannot improve those relations, they can gain something from the some kind of tensions, some ki this escalation, and the provocation from their side. One of the elements was, for example, Joseph Borrell visit in Moscow. That was a clear provocation from Russian
In January,
in I think that in February, 4th of
or in
February.
February.
Right, because it was, I think that you think about those protests of Navalny, and after January protests of Navalny, actually Jose Borrell went to Moscow and he was smashed by Sergey Lavrov, and etc. I probably you also had this on agenda in your podcast. I've heard some discussions that you already had it on that. So
Yes.
let's not go to the details, but that was one of element that Russian authorities decided to act. So the diagnosis from their perspective is that the European Union is weak. So let's push harder because they will not do anything. Okay, Russian, I mean Germany and France, and even Hungary. In some cases, Italy will all the time talk about the need of dialogue with Russia, even if they considered Russia as a challenge, as a threat, as a rival, and etc. etc. So, why Russia's authorities are doing that? Especially, they need to show to their own citizens that they are surrounded by enemies. And it's also a con as a con a consequence of the failure of Corona diplomacy, because Russian authorities were push Corona diplomacy towards, for example, Italy or to Hungary, and at the same time they were trying to somehow influence the Eastern policy of the European Union. And even Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, he was saying that let's talk with Russia because during the pandemic we need to cooperate all together, and the China is rising, so let's do the deal. And at the end of the day, they did not. I mean, the European Union did not reject the sanctions toward Russia, and Russian authorities decided, okay, this is not the way that we need to or we can go further. So, if there is no possibility of pushing the sanctions apart and have a deal with countries like France and Germany, especially after the Navalny case. So let's confront them and see what will happen, how they will react. And actually, many Europeans are actually afraid of some kind of escalation from a Russian side. So, okay, let's. The reaction is very different when it comes to the different parts of Europe. In this particular region, as we are, for example, from Czech Republic nowadays, and this diplomatic war, we can observe that Baltic states, Central European countries, except Hungary, unfortunately. And the west of Europe is deeper towards Russia. So it's getting deeper division between how we should, as the Europeans, follow the policy towards Russia.
Russia wanted to export anti-COVID vaccines to Europe as a part of the deal. Thanks to which they expected the sanctions to be rejected. Does that is that and it didn't happen. So is it what do you mean by the failure of Corona diplomacy?
Exactly. Faced with the failure to get the EU sanctions lifted, Russia has decided that any improvement in relations with the EU will not take place soon. But the confrontation should bring tangible benefits. So, in face of Russian pressure, supporters of dialogue with Russia, particularly France and Germany, or countries benefiting from cooperation with Russia, like Hungary, Slovakia, will not pressure that country on democratization or not protection of human rights, including Navalny case, right? So nowadays, what we are observing that, for example, Mr. Macron is talking with President Putin. Let's talk about Navalny only in case that please do not kill him in colony. Not about his releasing because he was jailed without any like law conditions and reality. So, and at the same time, Europe is so concentrated on its own problems after pandemic. So Russia thinks that they will leave all these sector like post-Soviet space to Russia, Belarus, Nagorno-Karabakh and Ukraine in particular. So this in this environment, yes, Russia is taking the advantages of the confrontational policy towards especially European Union, but at the same time they are trying to test all the time. We will observe it in the future. They will try to test US again.
Since you already mentioned Navalny, let's focus on him now, because it's obvious that for the Kremlin, Navalny is like the public enemy number one right now.
Right.
But I would like to know what is the real support for Navalny, you know, in the Russian society.
Yes, this is a very important issue that somehow the West, after his poisoning, started to believe in something which do not exist, meaning that Navalny can be another Putin or can replace Putin. And we were involved in such a discussions, how about Russia and Russia's Navalny Russia, right? That is coming very soon. So we were like in some kind of bubble of optimism about the changes in Russia. So let's be a bit realistic that in Russia, support for Navalny is not very high. But it's changing accordingly to what Russians are, you know, getting information from. So for people at the age above 55 and older, they do not support Navalny at all. But young people who gather information from internet, 45% of them are supporting Navalny, but in the general, only 19 or 20% of Russians are supporting the ideas and the policy or and himself as an oppositioner. But what Navalny brought to Russia, it is a possibility or maybe alternative to towards not Putin himself, but alternative to the system and his actions in broader perspective is weakening the system. So that's why Vladimir Putin is trying to forget about Navalny and bring him to, you know, the silence, not killing him, of course, but keep him quiet. And it is also a failure for authority from authorities' point of view, because people still recognize who is Mr. Navalny. But at the same time, Russian authorities are bringing so many and imposing so many repressions towards any kind of activities in Russia, politically, social activities, not only those who have some kind of political aspirations, but also to any kind of active people. They are trying to marginalize those people, and especially since a few days we know that Navalny's foundation was recognized by Russian court as an extremist organization and will be forbidden. So all the members of Navalny team, which are in all of Russia regions, they are present. They need to be cut off and change their formula and the organization, because it nowadays it is forbidden in Russia.
Yeah, I totally agree. Having an alternative to the Kremlin's rule, this means a nightmare, and Putin cannot accept it. This is clear, and for sure, Kremlin will certainly want to limit all activity of Navalny supporters, other social actors. But you have said that the regime is also imposing some restrictions on societies, on those social actors, on activists. What are these restrictions, this measure that the Kremlin is using or uses already and may use still in future?
Yes, this is, you need to consider those package as a media package with the whole propaganda, at the same time full of repressions and getting prisoned people who are even sharing some posts in Twitter on ITKONTAKTE, or like in social media, and hold the legislative package, because see, in the year 2020 and 2021, I mean, just to prepare for the elections in Duma in September this year, authorities have extended the questionable foreign agent status to not only institutions, but to particularly people, especially journalists, bloggers, NGOs dealing with politics and receiving any financial support from abroad. The status may apply to any natural or legal person. At the same time, they recognize a foreign agent must also state this in the elections campaign materials. So anyone can be a foreign agent, and next steps are that if you are recognized, you as a person are is recog you are recognized as a foreign agent, for example, you cannot be elected, and then you cannot have speeches to people, you cannot have any kind of activity, because authorities, like a big brother, they are watching you, and they can sentence you on any reason. So those package of legislative and also practice, because some legislative norms were imposed in 2019, for example, to sovereign internet, but nowadays it's just beginning to act. It means that any activities in internet can be watched by authorities. And at the same time, Russian authorities try to test how they can block any information or platforms to spreading information which are not controlled by Russian authorities. So probably you remember that on March 10 of March, they started to block Twitter in Russia. And they also recognize that especially internet is a sphere that they cannot control, and they are not winning this information warfare in Russia, of course. So they have a problem, especially Mr. Putin is having problem with communication with his own people. And even if he's gaining a quite high level of approval from Russian society, those who are living in the internet, in social media, and especially this is the younger generation, they do not accept Putin anymore.
Okay, so limiting activities offline and online as well.
Right.
That's the direction Kremlin takes right now. Probably the last question I will ask is about the parliamentary elections this year, and what all of this we have discussed mean for in this context of election. I understand that foreign policy will not impact the result of election. It doesn't have so much impact on Putin's ratings. But still, as you said, younger generation is not that supportive for Putin. Navalny's imprisonment cause sparked some huge protests in Russia. So, how do you see that? It will be organized in such a way that Russia will not, or the Kremlin will not risk anything, and it will be very artificial process just to ensure the elections, or do you think that still opposition has some chances to be elected and play more important role in Russia's politics?
I think that opposition will have less and less possibility to act in any direction or any environment. This is something that authorities nowadays are trying to limit to zero. But at the same time, the ruling United Russia is unlikely to repeat the results of 2016's elections when it won a constitutional majority in State Duma. This time it will be forced to struggle for parliamentary election majority. The United Russia is even less acceptable by Russians than even Mr. Navalny, because the support for United Russia is around 20 to 30%. It depends on the moment.
But sorry, one more question here. Is United Russia perceived as Putin, or it's rather there is Putin and United Russia?
Okay, so Putin is not a member of United Russia, and if but everyone knows that it is his party, and it accommodates any legitimacy towards Putin himself and for the system, because actually, we cannot separate those elements in Russia. Like there is a Putin and there is a Duma, or there is a Siloviki, and they are struggling for power. No, the system, Putinism itself, is a system that we need to consider as a whole. So there are some disputes in the different circles, but at the same time, the system is strong enough. Because it's having lots of instrument, especially force instrument and legal instrument, to win another elections and to rule for many years. What is the main goal, or let's say the main fear for Putin himself and that system can exist? It's exactly the color revolutions. He's really afraid of it, and that's why all those actions around Russia in foreign policy and inside Russia is going accordingly to that fear, because he can control every system from top to the bottom, but bottom up people and activities he cannot control at all, and he feels that after especially pandemic, this social mood can influence to any kind of his support, which is we need to consider United Russia as a proxy for himself and his position in the system. So nowadays, what is quite interesting for the researcher of Russia, that Russian authorities trying to somehow follow up the spectacle of democracy. That, for example, they've created in the mid of 2000, they inspired by the present administration, few new political parties. For example, the party New People for Truth, Green Alternative, come on, there is something in Russia like this, so, or Direct Democracy Party. So they can gain around 10% of voters. What is interesting that this is new parties, and Russian authorities, especially towards the young generation, are giving a message, come on, you can have an alternative towards United Russia. So if you are not supporting United Russia, which is like element of the system, see, you have the alternative. But it's actually what you've said, artificial alternative, created as a systemic opposition, just to bring to take people to the to voting process and to again show Russians that they are living in democratic country.
Yeah, that was my question, because if United Russia cannot achieve probably constitutional majority, they will try to allow to enter the parliament other political parties which are technically, or they are presented as independent, but in fact they are also controlled in certain extent by the Kremlin. That's a possible scenario, if I understand correctly, right?
Right. And Levada Center, which is independent opinion pool center, made a let's say broader or like investigation who is supporting United Russia. So in general, the average is a woman, 55 above, living in the small city or in the village, with the middle education level. So this is the person to whom United Russia can somehow make a message or take these voters as their strong base. So to summarizing, there is a huge gap between older and younger generation, how they perceive the political future of Russia. But unfortunately, many of young generation is just living Russia for years, and this is like weakening the possibility of change in this country.
This is interesting. Very quickly, where are they living? To the west or other directions too?
In most of the cases, the West, especially European Union, the Cyprus, or sometimes to Ukraine, to Belarus, not now, but before that, the Belarus also was quite interesting. For example, for IT workers, nowadays it's not possible anymore. But yes, United States, Canada, and the broadly speaking, the West. And what is really pity for this country that many academics are one of the more than half academics. There were also some research about that. More than half academics, who can be profitable for the economy, for development of Russia, is leaving Russia after they gain some success, and just after that they leave the country.
This is very interesting topic. I hope we will have occasion to discuss it next
Hope
time,
so.
because today I think this is enough. I hope that we have described this most the most important developments in Russia. And yeah, maybe after the elections in Duma, we will meet again, and we will verify how the situation looks like in Russia, and then maybe we can also talk about other issues, as for instance this migration which is also interesting. Thank you, Agnieszka, very much for joining us. It was a pleasure to talk to you again.
Thank you, and I hope to see you or hear you next time to talk those fantastic from a research point of view topics.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
That was Maciek's interview with Agnieszka Legutska from the Polish Institute of International Affairs and a professor of security studies at Wisła University in Warsaw. Maciek, thanks for doing this interview. It, as we said in the beginning, it was quite long, but I think it's very interesting to hear, of course, Agnieszka's analysis. It's always very, very good and very strong, and her perspective on the different factors that have played into the situation. And you guys really covered a lot. I mean, not just the situation, the military situation in the region, but you also covered a lot of the kind of the social situation, including the Navalny arrest and the repressions, the corona diplomacy, and of course the upcoming Duma elections. So a lot that you covered. I thought for me what was really interesting was to hear Agnieszka's analysis, particularly on some of the reasons why the buildup did not go further. The fact that the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, I think, is one of those key factors that it has not been, it's not in operation yet. And really the question is, once Nord Stream 2 is in operation, does that just give the Kremlin stronger motivation, let's say, to turn up the pressure on Ukraine and maybe even more dangerous type of activities, which I hope we don't get to. But it was for me a very interesting discussion and a wide range of issues covered.
Yeah, I really value Agnieszka's expertise because she always brings not only geopolitical dimension, but she also focuses on what is going on in Russia, inside Russia. And I think this is a must to, you know, understand better the whole situation, because only then we can have a more comprehensive picture of the situation. And of course, this is also a factor that will be important for future developments in relations between Russia and the West. What is taking place in Russia? Because as she mentioned in the end of our interview, there are a lot of social problems for Russia, and you know, this emigration process, which we will try to cover in future, is a part of the story. So this is also interesting how and to what extent the internal social situation in Russia may change Russia's foreign policy. This is, of course, a very broad topic, but I think worth it to explore. And what you have said, or as a summary, the most important points from the interview with Agnieszka is that, you know, and that was interesting to me to hear that this now this current situation with the troops at the border of Ukraine, it was also a kind of a test.
Yeah.
Test for Ukraine, how strong is the Ukrainian regime. It was also a test for the West, but the West understand rather as United States, not United States plus the European Union, because as Agnieszka said, Russia wanted to check how strong Biden administration wants to be in supporting Ukraine. And the positive thing is, I think I agree here with Agnieszka that this test was passed by the United States.
Mm-hmm.
What worries me is that Russia really perceives European Union as such a weak actor right now. So I think it's also a lot of work on the EU side to improve, you know, the approach,
the image, yeah, of the EU. I agree, and I maybe actually in some senses the Kremlin underestimates the European Union as a bloc of countries that I mean,
I
if
think
we,
so. I
yeah,
think so.
and seeing, these other reactions in some of the countries, like, especially the Czech Republic, and other EU countries, where they expelled Russian diplomats for actually doing intelligence and criminal work as well. I think it should be a sign that it's not as weak as they may perceive it. But of course, as you mentioned, I think the test was really aimed towards the Biden administration. I agree with that assessment.
And you can also say that it's good that the EU acts as it acts, and it's not more like an authoritarian regime. I think it's we didn't want to have this geopolitical power politics between Europe and Russia, because it will be probably at cost of the central European states and smaller states in general. But what is also important, I think, and that's my hope, that the EU and Western Europe might be slow in reaction and not always accurate as we would like to see, for instance, here in Central Europe. But still, Western Europe and the EU as a whole bloc is able to catch up, I think. Every time there is a crisis. So I agree with you when you said that Russia may underestimate the EU and the EU's response.
We have to keep in mind that this European Commission has declared that it wants to be a more geopolitical player. So, there are plenty of opportunities to demonstrate what that means, and I think maybe this was one of them, and we will see how it goes in the future. Okay, Maciej, thanks for this discussion. I think there's a lot of food for thought, and it was really fascinating. And we will continue to, of course, keep an eye on the situation, especially if, as we mentioned, the troop withdrawal doesn't seem to be fully withdrawn, as they previously announced. So we will keep an eye on that. So I think we can move now to the announcement section, the final section of our podcast, which is always still very important. Maciej, do you have anything you would like to share with our listeners?
First of all, I would like to say hello for all new members of our Facebook group. I have seen in recent days that some people ask for a membership, and we of course approve that, because this group is open for everyone who is interested in our project. For new listeners, I may say that this group is our basic tool to be in touch with the entire community of Talk Eastern Europe. Here in the group, you can find information about upcoming episodes or new episodes. We also try to publish some information about the New Eastern Europe magazine, and also some announcements about special meetings. But those meetings are usually designed only for our patrons, which is a special benefit for people who support us financially. And I think, having said that, this is a great moment to say thank you for all our patrons, which is now quite a nice and quite a big group of people.
That's right. That's right. And if you're listening out there and you are considering supporting us, we would love to have you join our group of patrons. We have comfortably a group of 31 patrons right now, and they are, as Maciej said, able to receive extra benefits for supporting us. Not only do you support the podcast, help us, keep our studio in Warsaw, which we are going to be using more and more as this pandemic is finally coming to an end. But also we have special benefits, including special meetings, online Zoom meetings with experts on various issues related to what we cover on the podcast. But this is an opportunity to have direct interaction. And so we also have the benefit, which is repetitive, is the thank you to all of our patrons. And I have the pleasure to say hello and thank you to all of our patrons, including Eleanor, Olaf, Ian, Lorenzo, Marina, CB, Pat, Klaus, Plamen, Sean, Naomi, JP, Elise, Sean, David, Anastasia, William, Pavel, Urs, Ian, Sophia, Scapegoast, Wilhelm, David, Elizabeth, Erica, Janos, Jason, Mark, Stephanie, and Pierre. Thank you all for your support of the podcast. Some of you have been with us now for almost 3 years, and it's great, great that you've been supporting us and keeping us going. It also motivates us to continue developing the podcast.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you all very much, and we are looking forward for a new meeting with our patrons, and we will announce it via, of course, our Patreon profile and Facebook group, and probably via emails as well very soon.
Yes, do keep an eye out for that. I know we promised one in April, but we didn't manage. But this, we are working on finalizing the one for May. So keep an eye out, and we will see you soon. And if you want to join, if you're not a member of our Patreon group, please feel free to join us.
Okay, I think that's all for today. Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.